Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey everyone, welcome to the 263rd episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Richard Yeagley, Benny Rezikova, and Avery O. Williams. I'm Warren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got Craig Zobel on the show. He's a producer and director. He's done shows like American Gods, The Leftovers, Westworld, $1. He did the movie The Hunt, and most recently, he's here to talk to us about his new show, Mayor of Easttown. It's a new HBO mystery crime drama starring Kate Winslet. It's super
heard
cool.
Of her.
Yeah, yeah. She was
Titanic.
In that boat
if
movie.
You've seen Titanic. A lot of her.
I've seen Kate Winslet.
And it comes out April 18th.
A lot of her.
Yeah. So we dig in with him. He's got a really fascinating career. He also, in a weird twist of fate, he's got all these awesome dramatic pieces under his belt. You know, he went to school with David Gordon Green. He's part of that crew. I nerded out a little bit. It's a tiny bit embarrassing. And also, through a strange occurrence of events, he is...
Yeah, the multiverse.
He is the co-founder of the cult internet website, homestarrunner.com. So it's a real... It's an interview filled with twists and turns. We talked to a little bit about his movie, The Hunt, which had a decent amount of controversy stirred up and is a pretty bonkers movie. But also, we talk mostly about, I think, his roots in kind of these emotional, dramatic stories. It's really great.
Yeah. But what's cool about Craig is he, even though he's kind of known for a lot of these great performances and working with these amazing actors, he's done a ton of genre stuff. When I was at Sundance, actually, his movie was there, Z for Zachariah, which is only has three actors in him. But those three actors happen to be Margot Robbie, Chris Pine, and Chiwetel Ejiofor. And it's like this post-apocalyptic movie. So he's done it. I mean, it's kind of like a dream job, I think, for you or me, right? Which is like genre with like amazing actors. And he's done some real comedic things, some real extreme things. His movie Compliance, which was also at Sundance, it's kind of this crazy story. So I don't know. He has like this kind of awesome career. And finding out in this interview that he was also like the production manager on All the Real Girls is quite crazy.
He worked on George Washington as well. But so, yeah, he's got and also a number of his own indie movies as well that we talk about. So he's got these great indie roots. And we learn how he kind of built a career, leveled up, and is doing, you know, the most prestigious of network TV shows now.
Yeah.
Cable shows now.
He's also strangely nice, which, like, you know, you would think like at some point, if you've directed my favorite episode of The Leftovers, the one that really put Justin Theroux on the map as like this great actor.
You're not being facetious. You mean literally your favorite episode of The Leftovers.
Yeah. Have you? It's a really good episode. It's like, I mean, it's not just mine. Like, I think a lot of people agree that it is. It changed the trajectory of that show. And I mean, obviously there's writers and producers and a lot of other people involved in that, but he directed it and it was really good. But he's just like such a nice guy, which, you know, you kind of feel like when you've done all this stuff, and especially you've done Westworld, you worked with Nolan, you've done like these kind of real strong adrenaline pumped episodes of TV, you would think you would maybe have like a big ego or not, but Craig does not seem to have one.
I'll tell you what, I did walk away from that episode in a great mood. You know, it was just like really fun to record that one. So Hopefully it's as fun to listen to as it was to record. I think it will be, actually.
Yeah. Before we talk to Craig, I do want to mention that there's a high chance I will have a kid before the next episode airs. So if you want to send me some diapers or swaddle blankets, actually, I have a lot of swaddle blankets, just diapers and wipes, wet wipes, you know, drop them off in my house in Silver Lake. Just come to Silver Lake, just say, does anyone know where Oren lives? And you'll find me.
That's another way of saying it might take a minute for your Just Shoot It hat to get to you in the mail if you subscribe to Patreon in the next couple days, since Oren is doing all the fulfillment on that. But if you go to patreon.com/justshootitpod, you can throw a couple bucks in the coffer and maybe pay for a few diapers, or more likely actually just our editor, Sarah, and all of the other overhead that we have to make this show.
Yeah, having two kids, that's a lot of diapers.
That is a lot of diapers.
Even though one of my kids does not need them, but I think it is a worthy cause to join our Patreon, patreon.com/justshootitpod. If you give us 10 bucks, we will send you a Just Shoot It podcast hat. And like I've said many times, there's no better way to indicate to Matt or me that you are cool than to walk onto set wearing that hat.
Oh my gosh. The day that that happens, I will be so stoked.
It's not. So it's never stoked. Happened to you?
Happened to me all the time.
No, I've talked to people who listen to the show but not have worn their hat to a set of mine.
Yeah.
No, that's not happened yet.
I've seen, I've hung out with Carlin and she's worn that hat before.
I've seen her on the street, but she's not on your set. She's on her own set.
Well, I kind of consider all of LA my set.
Oh, I see. Well, listen, before we talk to Craig, there's one other thing worth pointing out. I'm sure you've noticed we've been running ads across all of our episodes, but we are giving away a ton of stuff from Blackmagic. And most importantly, for this week, we are giving away a Blackmagic Pocket 4K camera. And this is going to be baked into the episode, so go to our Instagram and check it out. There'll be an ad that'll clarify things a little bit more later. But if you're listening at home, too late. Once upon a time, we gave away a Blackmagic camera. It's pretty neat. Yeah,
and I'd say the odds of winning are pretty high, right? Like,
they're not bad.
Yeah.
Certainly entering for free is worthwhile. There's a handful of different ways to up your chances, but like, odds are good. It is worth it for sure. For sure.
Yeah. So check it out. It's an awesome camera, Blackmagic Pocket 4K, that you can have for absolutely free if you win it through our contest.
Oren, if I was to say to you, you could play one round of roulette for free, and if you hit, you would win a Blackmagic camera, would you enter?
Well, yeah, of course I would. I think our odds are slightly worse than that, but not that much worse.
Only slightly.
Yeah. So check it out. Go to our Instagram, instagram.com/justshootitpod, and look for the Black Magic post, the most recent one, and we'll have all the giveaway details in there.
If you want a more amped up, hyped up version of this explanation, stay tuned because I think an ad is going to start right now.
Awesome.
We'll see. Maybe not.
And here we go with either an ad or Craig Zobel. Hey folks, we're interrupting this incredible episode of the podcast to tell you about a new sponsor that we're working with, Front Row Insurance Brokers. One of the challenges of being a filmmaker is that there's a lot of risks that we take, and we really just want to focus on making good stuff. So what if there was a company that could take those risks, manage them for us while we are being artists?
That's right. Front Row Insurance Brokers arranges film production insurance to cover the risks associated with your production. They cover features, TV shows, documentaries, commercials, music videos, webisodes, basically anything you can watch on big, medium, or phone-sized screens.
Yeah, Front Row will help you focus on your artistic vision by transferring all the risks to them and minimizing your production hazards. And they cover any budget from $2,000 all the way up to $200 million. There's nothing that's too small or too big.
If you are shooting in Canada, use coupon code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF for $50 off your film production insurance. That's promo code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF to save $50.
And if you're shooting in the U.S., that same code can be redeemed offline by mentioning it to a broker, by email, or over the phone.
It's like a cool password if you're in the U.S. That's Just Shoot It 50 off.
Check them out. Let us know how it goes.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door.
Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
So, Craig, you're someone that I think we've... I think I was actually at Sundance when Z for Zachariah came
cool.
out. And so I think you've done so many things that we've all heard of, and we'd love to kind of hear where it all started. You grew up in Georgia... And then what happened?
I mean, first of all, thank you. It's flattering to think that people have heard of me. I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. I went to school in Winston-Salem, North Carolina for film and television. And yeah, that's kind of the origin, I guess, of everything.
So you have like a bachelor's in film?
Yes, that's right. Bachelor's.
So you knew you wanted to kind of do like write and direct.
My mom and dad owned a company that my dad was a lighting designer, but for television. So it was like mostly living in Atlanta, like it was like the early days of Turner things. So it was like he did some early like sets for like CNN, and then he did like the Weather Channel, you know, like things like that. And he was also a lighting designer. He was kind of like a televangelist lighting designer. So it's like if you were a, if you wanted to get into televangelism, you called my dad to like be like, what lights do I buy? So I kind of had kind of like seen enough of the universe to be like, ooh, I like that. That's cool. And yeah, that's how I ended
up. Cool. So he worked in TV and TV.
Yeah. yeah. I mean,
so was he practicing at home? Like he would just hang up like a bunch of in the living room?
Light, oh my gosh, our Halloweens were like really dope.
Yeah, I bet.
Light the heck out of them. Yeah. Yeah.
So did you, when you first realized like, oh, you want to make film, you want to be a storyteller, were you drawn towards these kind of heavy drama with like a little bit of, you know, plottiness to them on top of it, right? Like there's a layer of genre to it, but like at the heart of both Z for Zachariah and also the Mayor of Easttown, you know, it's like it's gritty, maybe is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, I think I wanted to make dramas. Like I was excited about that, and it was only kind of later once I started doing things, and really Compliance was how I started being like, I enjoy the rules of genre and the kind of like the things that you have to do in genre, and
I set you up a little bit, Craig, because if we go back to what I would think of as the true origin story of Craig Zobel, it starts with a little website called Homestar Runner.
Yes, Homestar
Runner. Which is kind of the polar opposite, I think, of these kind of prestige, you know, dramas, right?
For sure. Yeah, no, Homestar Runner was, you know, that all started like that, like, because of my dad. He was a lighting designer. He, when the Atlanta Olympics happened, he got hired to do a bunch of other companies like Olympic sets. So like he needed a lot of hands, and it was like my first year of college, and I got hired, and then like two of my buddies, we got hired to hang lights for like the Australian television network thing with my dad. And so we were just together like almost every day, and we ended up, you know, kicking around a bunch of ideas, and ended up like at one point going to a bookstore in the mall. We were like literally at the like novelty of like, when was the last time you went to a mall? And we went into the bookstore and somehow found our way to the children's aisle, and then somehow thought it was a good idea to like try to make our own children's book because all of them sucked that we saw in there. And so we made this little thing that we went to Kinko's and like made this like, you know, homemade book, and gave it to our friends, and it just became kind of this called Homestar Runner. And it just became a thing that we bounced around. And then at some point, you know, after college, we'd all graduated, and Mike had been a photo design major and was kind of like, I think I need to, like, I don't know that I'm going to, like, do this for the rest of my life. So he like, Adobe company had made this, like, thing called Flash, which nobody really, really knew it was. And he was like, let's learn how to use this. And, like, in order to teach ourselves the program, we started using Homestar as the sort of basis, and it turned into, you know, the like early cartoons, and all of a sudden one day, you know, 100 people watched it, and we were like, we didn't give it to 100 people, how did that happen? And then a couple years later, you know, it was like, it was certainly one of the early sort of web cartoons that, you know, people found, and Matt and Mike, you know, did it for years. Every week they would turn out a 3.5 minute cartoon. At some point I like was like, well, I kind of want to explore live action things, and I moved to New York. but yeah, that was sort of the in a way the origin. And what was cool about it was that as the site became, you know, first of all, just the site blew up to the degree that I remember being in New York and seeing somebody on the subway with a Homestar Runner tattoo, and mm-hmm. was like,
whoa,
wow,
a
somebody
tattoo.
Got my friend's weird animal character tattooed on their yeah. body forever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you say anything to that person?
No. No, it was New York. It didn't feel like a thing that you should.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, when I see someone with a Just Shoot It hat, and I'm like, hey, I'm the guy from Just Shoot It. And they're like, oh, I just got this at the thrift shop.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It was on the floor.
Yeah, like, exactly. I guess.
Yeah, no worries.
A little worried about
yeah, it. Like, cool, cool.
I don't remember. I was drunk when I got this tattoo.
Yeah, yeah.
I worked as a production manager and as a first AD, second AD, and then a first AD for several years before I was and I was writing the whole time.
And, like on narrative stuff, like on shorts and features.
Yeah, I David Gordon Green, I like worked on kind of all of his early movies.
Awesome! That's awesome.
From college. We knew each other from college.
Oh, right. That makes sense. So, wait, did you work on like all the Real Girls?
Yeah.
Dude, I love that movie. Love that movie so much.
I was a co-producer on George Washington.
Cool. So where's your Criterion? It's you gotta have a copy floating around, right?
Just like behind me.
Yeah. Sorry, but, yeah, I'm giving you a hard time, but I think it is interesting to think about, you know, because Oren and I both started, you know, making internet content, and I think probably a lot of listeners now who are younger, like it seems obvious, of course that's where you start, you know, you kind of cut your teeth that way, like it seems like there's no alternative, right? But I think it is very fascinating to see your trajectory, right? Because, and I guess it was relatively quick that you go from absurdist cartoons into heavy drama pieces, but like it just goes to show that just cutting your teeth is worth doing, even if it's not specifically what you're necessarily destined to make in the end. Do you know what I mean? Like, did you ever have a moment where you were like, oh, I'm making cartoons, but I want to make dramas, you know? Did you have that moment, or were you not worried about it too much?
I probably did. I don't 100% remember. But I also think that, you know, you don't really know. You should just make the thing that you're excited to make at the time. I don't know. Like, I don't think that anybody should be trying to design, like, what their style is or, like, what their, like, thing is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Do not find your voice, please.
Yeah.
Well, but you never find it by making things, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And your voice is like this. Sorry.
But I imagine you, like, writing Homestar Runner too, obviously you're learning a lot about, you're getting this kind of instant feedback, right? People reacting, sure. What's funny, what doesn't work, like what patterns are interesting,
absolutely. And there's just some like amount of confidence you get by like being like, wow, look, we made a thing for ourselves that other people actually think is interesting.
People like it. Yeah. That's very interesting. Yeah. Well, we don't have to belabor the Homestar situation. I had to get it out early because I'd be thinking about it the whole time.
But so now you're working for David Gordon Green. And are you like, look at this, if this guy can do it, I could surely do this.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, like we went to school together. So it was kind of tandem. Like actually, Matt Chapman, the voice of Strong Bad, is in all the Real Girls. He's one of the guys sitting around the fire in like a couple of scenes. So like all of us were hanging out together at the same time, really, you know? And I know that like, you know, they still talk and have projects going on together and stuff even now. So it was sort of just like the cool thing about going to school in North Carolina was that I was the third graduating class of that school at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say that there's that early crop that kind of everybody kind of made their name and then it sort of exploded from there. Right.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a thing where it was like, I think really like what happened was that a bunch of us wanted to help each other because there was no competition. There wasn't a vibe of competition that I kind of see. And I ended up like teaching at a school in New York for a little while. And like, I've seen kind of some of that, and that just didn't exist there because like, we had no hope. Truthfully. Oh, and there was nothing to do. It was just like the only thing to do was really go watch movies that you had to watch, you know, for school. So everybody was friends and kind of everybody, for instance, David Wingo, who did the music and he was the composer of Great World of Sound, my first movie, is like one of David Green's best friends. And, you know, like we all kind of like became friends with our friend groups and stuff, which is the reason to go to film school. I don't know another reason. You can learn all of the other parts by yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Crippling debt. Yeah, that's
the other thing. Yeah.
And so when you're working on like all the Real Girls and all, and I think like his movies are kind of known for these super like naturalistic performances and things. Like, are you picking stuff up? Like, is like, I guess I'm curious now that I didn't realize you had worked in different capacity, like how much are you influenced in your work moving forward? Because you kind of have, I think you're known for your performances as well, and I wonder how much of that you picked up from that other experience.
I think probably a lot. It really was in that way kind of a weird school of like, you know, it's like we all liked the same 70s movies. you know, truthfully. So I think a lot. And I definitely learned a lot. Look, I mean, being an AD or just working in the AD department, if I know some of your listeners aren't, you know, people who are already directing things or something, like I actually think that you touch all of the departments. If you want to learn how to direct something, it actually is really good. It's not an AD doesn't mean that you're a good D necessarily if you're a good AD, but like being in that department and being around that, you just get to hear like, oh, the props person is freaking out. Why is the props person freaking out? Oh, they're freaking out because like unbeknownst to me, like in order to do this or that thing, they have to kind of prep all of this other stuff, or, you know, the wardrobe person like needs to know about this or this or this thing. And like, you just kind of learn, I don't know. I felt like I learned a lot about how the sausage got made in a real way from doing that.
Yeah, I love that. It's funny because I feel like we certainly talk to a lot of different directors who come up from different directions. So like there's a lot of editors, you know, like a handful of DPs and stuff. But I think you're the first person to advocate for learning as an AD. And I like it very much because it's something where, you know, you if you have a logistical head, but you like to be on set and being on set is important to you, you know, and like you said, learning how the sausage is made is part of that. I feel like there are a lot of other departments that maybe don't have as global of a perspective, basically.
For sure. I think if you want to be a producer in any sort of sense, you must spend time in the AD department to really kind of like really kind of understand what that job is. But I, as a director, I just, the practical upshoot of it is that you learn things like going like, hey, I want to do this thing, but I know that it's going to be complicated for this department that I don't know that everybody thinks about. You know, it's like, this is going to suck for like transpo if we do this thing, because like they're going to have to figure out how to get everybody from this place to that. Like you just kind of have some sense of like, well, how can I get all of the things that I want to have happen today, which as a director is, you know, you're pretty selfishly like, what I want to have happen is what's important.
yeah. I do.
But like, how do you figure that out?
How do you figure that out? Yeah. Yeah. Like seeing the dominoes doesn't mean that you don't decide to not tip them over. Right. Yeah.
Sure. But like, it's good to kind of know like what you're asking in a way. And like that like leads to less like frustration and like foot stomping about like, you know, anything, like, because you just sort of know, okay, well, this is a pretty complicated stunt that I'm asking everybody to do. We should probably assume that this is going to take 4 hours and not, you know, not scream and yell at about it, you know?
Yeah. But I'm assuming the opposite is also true, right? Like, if you are asking for something like, hey, let's get, you know, all our extras to do this, like, start here, go over here, and then this car should come over here. And then the AD says, well, that's impossible, and that's not safe, and that's this and that. And you're like, well, I've done it multiple times, you know? Yeah. Like,
for sure. I mean, you don't ever want to, like, be in that kind of antagonistic relationship with your AD, I would hope. But, like, it certainly helps have that conversation. Because the trinity of the, like, AD, the DP and the director, they all have to kind of be like, if you're on a set where those two of those three people are fighting with each other, it's just a bummer.
So you'd mentioned that Homestar Runner was something that had enabled you to do your first feature. How did that happen?
Oh, right. So, you know, Homestar got popular and it was always free. I mean, it still is free. It's the same as it always has been. It was a time period where like people were trying to get you to like subscribe to get to watch like a web cartoon and stuff, which just no surprise didn't catch on. So we didn't try to do that at all. We just made it free, and then we started selling t-shirts and stuff. And you know, I at the point that it was all clicking forward and really like kind of burgeoning around 2000-2001, those guys were doing the whole thing, and I was, you know, I was in New York, so I was very marginal in the whole thing. But my little tiny piece of the pie helped me be able to make Grey World the Sound, which was a movie I'd been writing for a very long time and had been an AD. And I actually I was offered a job to kind of move up and become I wasn't in the union, which at that time was easier to kind of work and not be in the union in New York than I think it is now.
You mean as an AD, you weren't in the union?
As an AD, sorry. Yeah, as an AD. So I was a non-union AD, but I had like the call sheets to like become a union guy if I wanted to, and was starting to get offered those jobs. And I remember like one of those where I was like, man, if I take this, then I'm just an AD. And I was like, I'm gonna not do this, and I'm gonna see if I can make a movie with the small amount of money that I have. And and I just kind of begged everyone I knew to you know, work for peanuts, and I had got to know a lot of good people over the years because I had been an AD. So it was like, hey, what are you doing, sound mixer? What are you doing? You know, like so on, right. So on and so forth.
I'm curious, but at this point, you already had, you know, worked on some bigger movies, some kind of indie darlings, some other things. What did you ever think, like, oh, maybe I can bring this to a production company in a studio or get it made on a bigger scale, since you knew all these people?
Yeah, I didn't feel like I knew who to call to give me money. I think I maybe kind of toyed with that, but that just didn't feel like that was actually going to happen. Like, that felt like the kind of thing that you say to yourself, that's what I need to do. But, like, I was kind of at a true crossroads where it was like, do I want to be an AD or do I want to direct things? And like, wanting to direct things, I think, overrode the patience that I would have had to have to see if this person was down to give me money and have them say no after like 6 months or a year. I just didn't want to do that. I'd watched all of my friends do that and it just looked painful and terrible. And
yeah, and slow, most importantly.
Just slow. Well,
right.
Yeah.
Like, you've realized you're at a crossroads. You don't want to sit
this
at that.
The thing that I want
to
do.
Yeah, yeah. Because the worst thing would be to like be like, okay, I want to be a director. I don't want to be an AD. I'll send this to an agent, and then they'll get back to me in 6 months. And I could have taken that AD job, and I just sat in my apartment sad for 6 months waiting for them to say no.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. I mean, it is that weird kind of conservation of energy that I think you guys have talked about on your show before, like just in terms of like, you're always trying to figure out how do you move your thing forward while also just working in order to pay the rent. And it was like, I had made the choice to stop working and stop
paying rent.
Yeah, stop yeah. That part, you know, like I was like, okay, this is the time that you have to jump in order to do it. And I could have had better resources, I'm sure, had I done it a different way. But I was just like, I think I just felt really strong about the idea for the movie. And I was able to convince enough people to kind of like want to do it. And, you know, like my hopes for that whole thing was very simple. It was just like, if we got into Sundance, then it would be a dream come true. I don't care about anything other than that, you know? And it's like, it did. So that was fun.
Yeah. It turns out you cared about more things than that.
And then all of a sudden it's like, actually, if it gets distribution, I care. You know, and then it's like, and then if it gets, you know, whatever, like if it's well reviewed. And I actually like kind of did have an emotional crash after that movie because I hadn't really set myself up for anything other than just like doing one movie. And so like after it, and it was, you know, I won a Gotham Award for breakthrough director for it, which was like, and we got to be in new directors, new films at the MoMA. I was like, I did everything I wanted.
Sure.
I like didn't kind of know what to do after that and was wildly depressed for several years.
And this is your first movie, Great World of Sound, we're talking about.
Correct. Great World
yeah,
of Sound.
Yeah. I
first
love
movie
that,
gets into Sundance.
But the to me, the thing of like, oh, I did it, my dreams have come true, now what? I think is a thing that a lot of people have to deal with, right? Where you, especially you grow up thinking like, oh, if I made it to Sundance, that would be it. Or whatever that kind of like funny sort of niche goal is, you know? Like it's a thing your parents don't understand or whatever. Like I in college, I really just wanted to get a music video on like MTV2's indie rock late night block, right? And when I did, I was like, well, what now? I hadn't thought past it, right? And that's obviously a much smaller goal than, you know, premiering at Sundance. But still, it's the same sort of thing of like, you don't realize when you're young that that's kind of just like step one, right? You're at the end of the beginning.
I fell off a cliff. It was quite a like emotional time. And I wrote like things that like, you know, I couldn't put together for one reason or another. I also, like, right after my Sundance, there was when the Writers Guild strike happened, which was it sort of stopped the industry for a while. I feel so bad for the people that were like went to Sundance 2020 because like I know their pain, you know, which is like the momentum. It's hard to like regain the momentum in a way.
Did you get like repped and kind of meetings and
yeah, all that stuff? Did. I got an agent out of all of that.
And did you stay in New York?
I did. Yeah. And but it was like, well, actually, I went back to Georgia for a little bit. Around that time, I was real like not sure that I knew what I was kind of doing, and I had written like some things that I've looked back on and were like, these were fine, these were good stories, but I was very kind of like, that's not good enough, and kind of threw away a lot of work that I did. And I was involved in this thing called No Borders, which is done by the IFP, now the Gotham organization in New York. And I had the script that was all about, it was like a series of crime stories that was in West Virginia that everybody was like, nobody wants to, like, what is the opioid crisis? Nobody wants to talk about this. Like, they literally, it was like,
that
just
will
a
never
little
be
too
interesting.
Early.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just too early. Yeah. And I couldn't get anybody interested in this. I had gone, like, my, like, soul searching had, like, at some point I had, like, spent, like, 2 months in a nunnery in, like, southwestern West Virginia, you know, like meeting people.
I didn't even know they let men in there.
Well, it was like that was the only place. There wasn't any hotels, so it was like the only place that you could possibly like rent a room at all. And I had like done, I thought, you know, like looking back, that was a pretty cool script, but I just sort of, I wasn't getting traction with it and felt pretty like bummed out. And I met, you know, some producers that were like, hey, we're not, that doesn't sound right for us, but we're looking for, if you have any sort of a thriller idea, we want a thriller. And I was like, well, I've been writing just to, cause I'm sort of curious about it. I've been sort of toying with this idea. And I sort of explained the real life scenario in which Compliance was originally based on. And I had just read about this. It was a true story. And I was kind of like, in my brain, I'd always been like, how did that happen? What did those people say to each other? So I kind of pitched it to him, and he's like, that sounds great. Like, if you want to do that, we would totally, you know, fund that. And it was like, all of a sudden, there was a ticking clock on, like, getting this guy a script that I don't think I probably could have gotten out of my depression. And I also don't think I would have been ballsy enough to make that movie had I not been, like, in a place where it was like, well, this is going to be an art project, and then after that, I'll just go be a graphic designer or something. It's like, maybe right. Matt Chapman and Mike Chapman will have me back. But that's sort of how I made Compliance.
Person that told you they wanted a thriller, did they say, here's like an advance, or here's some money to go write it? Or was it just like, oh, that sounds interesting, go write it?
Oh, no, I was like, I think that by the time I was done with Compliance, I was about like $35,000 in credit card debt, just because I just didn't have a job. But I did, you know, I would get weird kind of jobs here and there. Like I was the field producer on an HGTV show for a little while. Like I did little things, you know, here and there. But
I think that's worth pointing out as well, though. It's like there's that feeling of like, well, I just made a movie and I went to Sundance and stuff. Like I should be rich. Oh, I guess I should take this field producing job at HGTV. And that's okay. Do you know what I mean? I think it's kind of, that's the premise of the show is like, you know, you have to survive somehow, right? So like, there's a lot of things that we gloss over that you don't bring up in interviews that are like, no, this is how I survived while I was making these other things, you know?
There's no correlation between like number of deadline article mentions and income.
Sure. Not at all. Yeah, zero. Totally. Zero correlation.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking at some random website called thenumbers.com, and it says that Compliance, the production budget was $270,000. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I think it was, I mean, I want to say it was maybe a little more than that. It was probably like $300,000. And so again, I went from like $84,000 for the first movie to like $300,000 for the second movie. Not a lot of money. And now, I mean, all of that was like, you know, great rule of sound for the amount of money that was like, was pre-HD video.
When did you shoot that on? On film?
Well, we shot some on video because there's this like documentary kind of element that we shot. It's about like a music producers. You can get it on Amazon Prime. It's about these guys who are music producers that like basically work for like a shady record company where like people come in, they put an ad in the newspaper and say, like, record company, come to your town one weekend only. Do you have what it takes to be famous?
Right.
And then, like,
that's how Rebecca Black got her start, right? Friday style.
Right, exactly. And but it's like, obviously it's like mostly it's like you come in and it's like, Oren, I'm not going to lie, I have heard some really good people today, but I think you really have what it takes. You know, you really have it. Your demo is not great and we're going to have to redo that. And that's going to cost some money, you know, a couple thousand dollars. But once we do that, it's going to be a real hit. And so we shot all of the times where there were actual people coming. We put real ads in the newspaper and had real people come in and talk to our actors and had our actors like sell them. Until at some point, like the actors would
like
be
with
like,
a hidden camera, or you just had people.
Yeah, with hidden cameras.
Oh wow.
Yeah, but it was done in a way where we built a set, and obviously, as in terms of like, at some point we would stop and be like, "Don't ever answer these ads again. Here, come backstage. Look, there's all these hidden cameras. Do you want to keep going? Do you want to still be a part of this movie?"
And they're like, "Oh, a movie? Yes, I do."
So that stuff we shot on video, but most of it we shot on 16mm film because that was what you would do.
That's what a real movie looked like back then. Yeah, wild.
And Pat Healy was in that, which is kind of like the easy way into Sundance, right? You just put him in your movie.
Well, I mean, I want to say that maybe it was one of the first movies that he went to.
There you go. You're paving the way.
And then, so for compliance, was it hard to get like Ann Dowd? And was Dreema Walker, had she done much before then? Was that this kind
no,
of a breakout?
Ann was kind of famous in the theater world in New York, but hadn't been on too much film and television stuff. And Dreema the same. Pretty much everybody in that were just great New York actors. So,
well, awesome. I feel like we could dissect your early career for three or four more episodes, but I think we should fast forward to your current show, Mayor of Easttown, right? Because I did want to talk a little bit about, you did a ton of episodes on this show. I'm curious to learn a little bit more about your approach to the something like this big. You know, there's a lot of episodes that you're dealing with, and you were also producing director on these as well. So like, you kind of, it's a whole season of television basically that you're kind of keeping tabs on, right? Talk to us just a little bit about like your initial approach. Like, how do you tackle something this big?
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting. You know, I had actually done, so Mayor of Easttown is like 7 episodes. And before that I had done this show that's on Paramount Plus called $1, which I did all of the episodes, all 10 episodes. It's a crazy thing to do. I wouldn't really advise that it's a good idea, but I did it once, and that's sort of how I ended up being the guy that did it again. Now maybe after doing it twice, I feel kind of confident that I like know how to do it, but it's kind of a bonkers thing to do. You know, TV is different than film in just a million ways. It's also very much the same thing. But the trick with this one was, Mayor of Easttown is about Marion Sheehan, who is this police officer in the what they call the collar counties around Philadelphia. And Kate Winslet, she was the most famous high schooler. she got the shot in the basketball game that everybody remembers. But then after that, her life has kind of been shit. And she gets involved in a murder investigation. So it's essentially an HBO murder mystery, but it also has this kind of real like naturalistic human drama to it. The truth of the matter is the genre part was the hardest thing to do out of order over the course of 7 episodes with a pandemic in the middle pausing you for a while. It was just like, wait, when does the audience know that thing happened? Like,
wait, so you started shooting pre-COVID and then you kept shooting during COVID?
We went down, you know, on March 13th, and then in around September, we went back to work. So we were an early kind of TV show to go back. Yeah, so it was wild.
And it's based on is it based on a book? Or
it's actually, I appreciate you saying that because the goal is to try to make it feel like it's based on a book.
Totally original.
Funny, yeah. It does genuinely feel like it's based on a book. Yeah.
Yeah, and I saw the first two episodes. Which I really enjoyed, and the second episode I finished at like 1 a.m. last night, and I was like, should I keep going? Because the end, you know, it's like a mystery thriller.
Sure, you want to know what happens
every episode. Something happens, and you really need to see the next episode. I couldn't quite tell. Does it take place now?
That's interesting you say that. Yeah, it takes place now. Those areas are like, you know, like, unique places. And so like those areas, you know, it's not supposed to be period. It is contemporary. But when we went into all the locations that we wanted to go to, we were like, oh, this is not what I expected. And you know, there's layers of history, right? Like there's like, it's like, oh, this place was decorated, you know, in like 1988. And then they like got that new couch in like 2004. And then like
that, and then they were good.
The Peloton over there, you know, they clearly got the other day or whatever. Yeah.
Right. It does have a kind of timeless quality to it. And I'm only asking because like, I know like a movie like Nomadland is based on a book, which did take place a few years ago. So even though it kind of feels contemporary, it's a little older. And but it, if you're making a show now, like my friend works on The Conners, you know, the ex-Roseanne show, and it is fully 100% aware of COVID. You know, it takes place in a world where COVID exists.
We had this big debate. Yeah, we had this big debate. I mean, we were shooting out of order. We were cross-boarding the entire series. Like, so we didn't have like one and two, episode one finished or something. Like we had parts of one, parts of seven, parts of four, you know, we had like parts of everything. So for us, it felt kind of dangerous to like try to like incorporate COVID into it just simply because, you know, of the way we had started the process. That was what also why it was like really important for me to like get it out soon so that it didn't feel like weird in a post COVID.
Well, but if the intent is to make it feel like it's kind of based on a book, then you kind of have to, you don't even have to worry about that.
Well, and I feel like the shelf life also is different too, right? Like I think, you know, especially now that there are these streaming services and stuff, an HBO show you can discover 2 years later. Right. And if it's like rooted in such a specific moment in time, then the question is not, oh, is the story good? It's like, oh, do I want to revisit that part of my life again? And in the case of COVID, the answer is most likely no, you know. So
right, yeah, right. It's like nobody wanted to watch a 9/11 movie forever.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like they kept trying to make them, and it was always like,
it was like, oh, are we gonna do this? I guess so. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm curious. You like, had mentioned earlier, kind of the rules of genre, and you know, there's. I think of The Killing, like when I see your show, which is like I was like a huge fan of, and really reminded me of that same feeling with like some red herrings and some twists and turns and things like that. Like what? What in your mind are some of the rules of this genre that keep people glued to the TV? You know, like what's your, how do you think about that?
I think I constantly think about whether or not the audience should be ahead of the characters in this or that scene, or whether the audience should be behind the characters in this or that scene. And you think it's obvious from the writing, but there's sometimes where you're like, well, like I think we were constantly on set like still like no, this is actually suspense, like they should know, or no, this is actually surprise, like they shouldn't know this beat. I feel like that's the, and I mean only time will tell whether or not we got it right. Like I think that we made good choices, but like, you know, that's really a thing that you have to wait until people start watching the show and tell you. But that's always, for me, it's just like, is the audience ahead in this beat, or is the audience behind in this beat?
And, well, and even with a mystery, there's also that tricky thing of like being mysterious versus being unclear, right?
Oh, you nailed it, Matt. I mean, that is the problem. Like the problem is when you think you're being like cool and sneaky, and actually everyone's like, what's happening?
Like, huh? I don't get it. Let's see what else is on. Yeah.
Well, also right, there's exactly. There's this thing that's very specific to these like murder mysteries, which is that you are setting up a lot of potential suspects, right? Like even in the scene, you know, before the crime happens, I'm sure like your lensing, the music, the editing, like what insert shot you decide to stay on for an extra second is important to remind the audience, well, this guy was looking at her in a weird way, and this girl had this planned, and this, you know, adult had, you know, told her not to do something, and like how you balance the edit.
I was about to say the edit is where all that stuff happens, though. Like, I found that it's funny because, like, you can have a million, the screenplay is going to have a million, like, guideposts. Like, there was absolutely things that we shot two ways. like where we shot, where it's like, be suspicious, be totally innocent, you know, like in terms of the performance of the actors, you know. And then
the actors all knew, they knew who did it from this, the first day, like kind of, it wasn't like a who, like in the Scream movies or something.
They right,
like,
just not
don't give
people.
Away. Yeah.
I mean, I've worked in scenarios that are kind of like that before. I always feel a little bit like, well, I trust that they're good actors and they'll like giving them as much ammunition as possible is useful. So I wanted to tell everybody, you know, working on it, it just helps, you know, the whole thing. Like, it's like everybody is like, well, if we want to mislead people in this way, maybe this prop should be used, or maybe they should be wearing this, or should they be sweaty here, or whatever. You know, like, it helps everybody.
Did you have any kind of guiding principles in terms of, you know, while you're on set, drawing out suspense or directing people in a certain way, or like any sort of craft-oriented thoughts on that? Like, oh, do we shoot the bad guy with this lens, or anything like that, or...
You know, this was a funny one in that, like, I would say that in the past I would maybe have done that sort of thing. I was absolutely chasing a very traditional, naturalistic-y kind of vibe here, because I had just done The Hunt, which is like a satire and is pretty weird and has like crazy camera moves like every 2 seconds. And I'm really proud of that movie and feel like it's fun, but I wanted to just kind of do, like, this was an opportunity to sort of do something more naturalistic. So I actually, like, withheld the desire to kind of, like, really, like, lean into, like, the like, well, if we put it on a, like, you know, wide lens and put it right next to their face, like, they're going to be totally suspicious. We do it a couple of times, but...
yeah, you know, yeah, like, but you, yeah. That's so funny, though. I'm so glad you reminded me that you did that movie, because, like... to go from The Hunt to an HBO prestige mystery drama, like, one thing is...
like, seems like the craziest move to make.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well done. Well done. Hat tip.
In terms of, like, how you covered a scene in there, you said, you know, you're kind of going for something really naturalistic, but I noticed just watching, like, the first couple episodes that you're really good at kind of, like, showing depth with the camera, but still in a naturalistic way. Like, there's a scene where Kate Winslet is with another character and they're walking out the door, but you shoot the scene, the end of the scene, through the door, like through the window and the door, you know, or like if she's in a store, you might kind of put the camera really far away and we see some shelves in the foreground. I mean, it's, you know, nothing that I haven't seen before, but there does feel like kind of an observation, like maybe someone's looking from afar at these characters and like,
a little voyeurism to it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's funny, like, I actually, like, it becomes into, like, the philosophy of lenses, which I don't know how much you guys talk about this kind of weird stuff on this
dig in. Let's do it. Let's do it.
Well,
give us some numbers.
I feel like telephoto lenses naturally feel dramatic. Like, just naturally, like, you feel like kind of like they just feel more serious, or I don't know, like, my association with the look from a long lens is like more serious. So like, if I want to have a person head to toe in the frame, but I want it to feel serious, I would rather walk all the way across the street and into the other parking lot and shoot it on a 200 millimeter lens. It just feels different. It's different than if it's a wide angle lens in the same head to toe like frame, but with a wide angle lens, just is a different story. It's wide angle lenses for me are like more, it's reductive to say that they're comedy, but they're like more like, they're definitely more action oriented, I think, and more kind of
exaggerated,
kinetic.
Even
exaggerated.
You know? Yeah, 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 for sure. Yeah, yeah.
Well, what about like establishing shots, especially when, you know, I think most of the work you've done kind of takes place in like in these specific landscapes or worlds or small towns or wherever it is. And you want to feel that. How does that?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I mean, the best way to get the best establishing shots I've learned is to not do them myself, but to like send the operator or whoever is the cool, you know, camera person on set, that
the hungriest person. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And yeah, give totally. Them a lot of photographs and be like, this is the type of, you know, William Eggleston photograph that I like.
Yeah, yeah.
Go that's find really this.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. Are you ever like, ah, dang, I wish that we had our characters walking into that house or walking out or something like that. You know, do you ever feel like you wish it was a little bit more connected, or is it always like, oh, these tableaus do so much for it?
That's a funny question. I mean, I think the mayor of Easttown has been the first time that I've like maybe had those kind of conversations, and it's that my collaborators like sort of like that more. So I tried to kind of embrace that. Like I hate an establishing shot of a like, this is the house. Now we cut inside the house. That feels very like 80s TV.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's always, I think, a full house, right? Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. But the reason but that those
kind of a usefulness to it, I'm sort of growing to appreciate why and where you use that.
Sure. Well, and I think on a show like yours, there is that kind of dance that you have to deal with, and maybe HBO is less of a problem where, you know, if you're dealing with rigid run times, right, and you're trying to get as much comedy in there or as much lyrical, like establishing mood or tone, like you want to let things breathe. Sometimes it's nice to be able to marry those, but like the tricky thing with like having somebody to go shoot those shots separate from the scene work is that then in order to kind of squeeze it in there, sometimes you do end up with that sort of like laugh track feeling pre-lap into the scene, you know?
If yeah. you can have that person like have a slider dolly or something like while they're doing it, so there's some movement in it, that's always useful.
Yeah, but also like, I think if I remember correctly, like the few opening shots of Mayor of Easttown are like not like a house, but they are kind
the
of
tableaus.
The feeling of
yeah,
the town. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are exactly what I just described. A person going out on their own, you know, and getting up at 4 a.m. so they can get the sunrise and all of that kind of thing while we're like churning away, making the TV show. I mean, that's a very TV show thing. Like if you're making your first movie, I would encourage everybody to go out and be the director of that thing. But, you know, of things that you can give up and say, like, go find me cool stuff. Here's a Pinterest page with 200 William Eggleston photos that I like. Right. Have fun.
Well, my last question about Mare, and then we can go on, is when you are doing a pretty good budget TV show for HBO and you have a dead body, is the actor playing the dead body, or do you just like have some lab technician?
It's a wonderful question. There was a dead body that was made, looked terrible, and we just said we're not going to use the dead body. And then, like, you know, in the scenario in which the dead body exists in that show, not to give anything away, but it's an exterior location, right? And it's like the winter.
It's pretty bright too. You know, there's not a ton to hide behind.
Then all of a sudden, you know that there's going to be a dead body outside in a bright scenario. You don't want to use the bad, bad, bad looking dummy. So what do? You build part of the outside set inside and you comp things in and do like visual effects. And that was a crazy thing. And like, you like figure out how to kind of do it with visual effects and prosthetic effects, which was a new one for me. I'd never done, you know, I was quite inspired by seeing the behind the scenes for Parasite.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I was just like, wait, yeah. All of the things in that house are just like made up?
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's like, not real?
Yeah, yeah. Like, just for people who haven't seen that video, like there's a handful of really great behind the scenes videos where you realize that most of Parasite is a VFX shot. But it's all relatively invisible. It's like sky replacements. That house doesn't really exist. It's like, you know, they're comping all, everything's a comp shot, basically.
Hundreds and hundreds of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not exaggerating. The majority of the movie has a VFX shot in every frame, basically.
Yeah. It has to be 70% of the
VFX. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is the guy that made Snowpiercer, so I guess it's not that surprising, but it is surprising when you see the movie.
When you're like, this is just a shot of a house.
Yeah, but like nothing is like a train at the end of the world. You know what I mean? Like like it's just a house. Yeah. You know, like so. Like we kind of did some things on Mare, which were like me being pushed out of my comfort zone in visual effects world of being like, oh, you can do some things like this in visual effects. And
I haven't seen Z for Zechariah, but isn't that's like a post-apocalyptic, right? Like it's three
people.
Yeah,
but it has like
alone.
Maybe like four or five effect shots. I mean, there's not much
really?
Visual effects in that movie.
How did you portray emptiness, like the empty world?
Just made sure that there was no one in the frame.
You said, excuse me.
Yeah. Can you move your Peloton out of the bike, out of the shot? Thanks. Yeah.
Well, I do, since you brought up Hunt, I think it is worth talking about a little bit because that was a movie that was like pretty controversial, right? Like it kind of like they were maybe going to release it theatrically and then they decided not to. Can you kind of refresh my memory on like the seesaw back and forth of the story of that film just real quick?
Yeah. So, it's based on that old story, The Most Dangerous Game, essentially, which is, you know, like people hunting people. It came out of like me doing The Leftovers with Damon Lindelof and Nick Hughes. After doing that, we had so much fun working on The Leftovers together that they were like, they kind of wrote it with, as a like, hey, like, you know, let's write this thing as like a Blumhouse type movie, like The Purge, and see if, and have Craig do it. And so, and I was like, I'm game, let's do it. And so the premise is essentially a people hunting people movie, but it has kind of like a QAnon kind of element to it. And it's all about sort of like a bunch of very rich sort of liberal elites who have been doxxed and kind of exposed and taken down by like a fake, you know, news story, decide to get revenge. And it was absolutely a, you know, commentary on all the things happening. But when it came out, a couple of weeks after the trailer premiered, there was the El Paso shootings happened, in which the guy wrote a manifesto and published it on 8chan, the like same websites that all the movies kind of was talking about, and the manifesto quoted like Trump and quoted like a lot of Fox News personalities and stuff. And so none of that cohort was very excited about that, and so they immediately pivoted to the oldest pivot in the world, which is the like, guns don't kill people, you know, like it's movies that kill people, you know. And they were like, this is one that we can throw to the wolves and be like, look at these like liberal elites like ruining everything, and they're the ones that are really at fault here. So it was, yeah, it became a thing that I don't think any of us anticipated it becoming. We knew that it was like, you know, we were like, it's supposed to be a cheeky, the reference was an early Sam Raimi movie. That was like my reference. I was like, I want to make, you know, Evil Dead 2, but like this, you know, so it wasn't supposed to be really serious at all.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
Not at all right. Serious.
No, yeah. Zoom, no 200 millimeter lenses.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
No, yeah. No, exactly. There are no 200 millimeter lenses.
Yeah, I bet there's a lot of 18, right? Yeah, yeah. It's like 18 millimeter close-ups right there.
For sure. Actually, yeah. Like, yeah. But, you know, it was supposed to be tongue-in-cheek and silly, but then it got kind of like twisted through this like thing. And eventually Universal was scared to release it at the time, which was a shame because I actually think that more people would have been curious to go see it if they just released it when it came out. But I understand. I mean, there was like legitimate concern that people would like go to a theme park or something, you know, like we just didn't know what was going to happen. And so yeah, I ended up, you know, the subject of death threats and all sorts of crazy things. It was very weird. And when you see, if you've ever seen the movie, it's like so not
sure. Yeah, yeah.
It's really not that movie.
It's like, funny that it's Evil Dead 2 is like the reference point, because like it is meant to just be, you know, bonkers, like the idea that someone would take it, or even that you would be worried that someone would take it seriously as like an indictment on things. Not that it doesn't have something to say, but like it's supposed to be a fun bonkers movie basically, and so it must have been a real surprise to realize
the movie within the realms of what it was. I feel like kind of speaks for itself, and it is, but like people were able to kind of frame it in a way before anybody knew what it was. Troublesome and hard. but it was, I'm like I said, I still, I feel like I can't wait for people to see that movie.
Stand by the movie. Yeah, yeah. It did well. It kind of found an audience like when it was ultimately released on VOD. It kind of was in like the middle of the pandemic. So I have a careerist sort of question, actually, because we were joking a little bit earlier about like, oh, you did this crazy movie and then you did, you know, an HBO prestige drama. Like, I guess, how do you feel like do you have any wisdom in how you were able to kind of like jump back and forth between things like that? Was it, you know, like how have you done it, Craig? I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
I guess it didn't. Nothing about Mare of Easttown felt out of the pocket for me. It actually, I found that to be exciting to get to like do drama, and I got to see like in understanding like what Kate wanted to do. Kate Winslet wanted to do in Mare of Easttown, I was like, oh, well, I've never seen her do that before. And I've never seen that character quite before. Like, that's a new thing. So I was like, this is, if we just chase like trying to make sure that like we like capture like, you know, this like very 2021 person that I know exists, you know, like I know her, you know, and we try to like tell that story, then we're fine, you know. So I guess it wasn't how did I get the opportunity to do that? It literally came from just having worked with mm-hmm. HBO before. And
yeah, I suppose that the real blip is Hunt, really, right? Like, you know, you've got like this great career with HBO, you've been working with them for a long time, all of that. So I think it, Hunt is probably the curveball in terms
but
of
I guess in my mind it feels like an outgrowth of working with HBO, because it was Damon Lindelof and The Leftovers that like introduced me to the idea. So yeah, I guess it's the curveball. It was fun to flex a different muscle and just get to be like, try to actively change your style, you know? Like
my last question about Mare is like directing Kate Winslet, who, you know, it's like an Oscar winner, right? Titanic, many things.
Yeah. Reader too. I keep thinking
the
of
reader is what reader. She won for.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah. And then obviously you did, you know, in Z for Zachariah, it's like three kind of known actors. Like, how is it directing them? Someone like Kate, where especially when it's a TV show and it's not a movie that you wrote, like how much do you tell her what to do, you know, on set?
You know, if I feel like she's off the, I've said this before in like other interviews and things, like I really do think there is some level that like the job of directing an actor is like kind of like being the first base coach in a way, where you're just like, I just think that you get the best stuff out of people by being an encouraging voice that's like, I like this, let's keep going that direction because that's really interesting to me and I haven't seen that, and like cultivating like your brain enough to be able to know and just to be able to quickly say like, I like this, I don't like that, you know. So I certainly feel like I directed her.
right and no, I didn't mean that. And yeah, I didn't mean that.
It's a good question. I mean, it's a question that it feels intimidating, I think, to a lot of people. But you also have to just kind of walk into those kind of situations and be like, well, they are people. They like, you know, wake up in the morning and drink coffee and, you know.
Right. And are self-conscious too, maybe at some point.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, do you, with her, do you do different versions too? Do you like, let's do like the more suspicious, the less suspicious, like, you know.
Oh my god, we did so many versions, it was so great. I mean, it was just like more, you know, like more grumpy, like more, yeah, like we would run the gamut of like, maybe there's a, yeah, that's literally what we would call it. I also, like, especially with TV, feel like it's really important to kind of like, instead of looking for the perfect performance, that's the way that I read it in my brain when I read the screenplay, it's just important to like have people try stuff with different intentions, where it's like, okay, now try it as if, you know, they're not going to give you the answer, or like, now try it, you know, as if like they're your mom and like you're kind of scared to tell them that this, like looking for like variations in like intent with the lines, because especially with something like a murder mystery like this, it's like you end up in a place where you're like, we actually need this person to be on the back foot there and not really confident, or, you know what I mean? Something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah. You're kind of, you're tuning the, again, the suspense of it all, the mystery, like where people are and what they've picked up on.
And then the editor room, you can use either one of those, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this sequence with Kate Winslet and this character, Tony, where you don't know if she's like scared of him or just like dismissive of him. And I really like that sequence too, because I can't imagine, like, if I was directing it, like, oh, maybe. I mean, it feels very scary, but she doesn't feel very scared, you know? And like, maybe I would be too chicken to not play like that exact emotion.
Well, we probably have the other version of it in the edit base. You know what I mean? Like, this was the most interesting one at the end of the day. You know?
Yeah. That's awesome.
Follow up on that. How many cameras were you rolling?
Two, mostly two. I feel like more than two, it's like a mess. Sometimes, like, more than two, like, you're in each other's shot.
Yeah. Sure.
And does HBO, do they have opinions on what camera you're using and what lenses and stuff?
No, not that I know of. I mean, there's a certain resolution you're supposed to be and stuff. Netflix had opinions on that, I think.
What did you guys shoot on?
We shot this on the Alexa, the big format Alexa.
Oh,
the LF.
Fine.
Yeah.
Actually, on that final question, we talked a lot about the naturalistic lighting, right? And I was trying to tell, like how much is really present there? Right, if you're shooting two cameras, are you lit 360? Is it sometimes? No. Yeah.
We're really lit for the A camera, and then the B camera like squeezes in a way that doesn't mess up the lighting for the A.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. I like that though. Yeah. Sometimes they call that 1.5 cameras.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's like one good one and then like, you know, their hands or something, you know.
Right. But sometimes like it's like a good second shot. You know, I mean, the one thing that I did find to be like really fun and interesting about COVID that I hope to continue forward was that one of my big rules in shooting during COVID was like, I was like, well, we can't have, I like dollying and I have a lot of dollies in my stuff. And I was like, we can't have two cameras and two operators and two dolly grips, you know, there. Cause that's like too many people, like less than 6 feet away from each other. Like that's going to be messy. So I sort of forced us into a shooting all the time with two remote heads, to the chagrin, I think, of the operators at times. They were frustrated, but I felt like that was the safe thing to do.
So you still have a dolly grip, but the
camera
assistant
on the remote,
and the operators.
The operator's using a, you know,
operators in
head.
LA, and you're shooting in like,
yeah, it's like a drone operator.
Or at
it's
least
in
like
VR.
Outside.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
He's
though,
at least
yeah.
like in the corner, which is, you know, it's not that unusual, but it was to have two of them on set every day is kind of a thing, you know? But what was great about it was that you could actually put two cameras in times that you weren't using the dolly. You could put like, you could get the like close up and the over the shoulder shot and actually like be tight enough for those to work, because usually there's human beings in the way, so like that one shot is always like really wide and doesn't look as good. So it was, I was like, this is brilliant.
So you could stack but still get as much operating out of it as you wanted, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Love it. Ah, that's awesome.
That's why I always hire incredibly skinny B-cam
up. Yeah, small and skinny.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe tall too. It was good.
Yeah, true. Tall and skinny. Yeah, one tall and one small.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, just like a cartoon duo of camera operators.
Yeah, Laurel and Hardy. Well, awesome. One last thing I want to say is that I'm a huge fan of the International Assassin episode you did of The Leftovers. One of the best episodes of TV that I've ever seen. So thanks for doing that.
Well, Craig, we could continue to talk to you genuinely for hours and hours, but we should probably wrap it up. But before we do you have time to hang out and endorse with us?
Oh, sure.
Unpaid endorsements.
Well, I will kick it off with the previous episode. I mentioned to Oren that I keep a list of potential endorsements because, you know, I always end up grasping at straws, and I only had one last time and it just said The Box. And I was like, I have no idea what this is. I don't know what this note reference is. I asked my wife, she reminded me. So The Box is what we've invented for movie viewing during COVID with our sister and with my sister-in-law. Basically, we have a box with like all of the different movies that would have been released theatrically, but that haven't been. You know, they're like on VOD or Netflix or whatever. So it's kind of all the big movies that are out.
Like the name of a movie written on a piece of paper?
Written on a piece of paper, just in a box. And each of us takes one, right? And then, you know, then we kind of decide which is the movie we're going to watch. And what's nice about it, we can veto it. You know, we have a choice of three different movies. So typically we'll find one that we want to watch. But it feels sort of like you're going to the movie theater.
Wow.
It kind of replicates.
So it's like, the Snyder Cut. It's already 10 p.m. We can't watch
Yeah. Yeah, that's what the veto is for sure. But like, you know, it's a way of being able to say like, okay, we're staying current. But it's Friday night. We're just going to go to the movies and just see what's playing, basically. And has actually genuinely been really fun. And more times than not, we end up watching a movie that we probably wouldn't have been at the top of all three of our lists. But we ended up really liking, actually, and it's really fun. So that's my recommendation, is replicating the inconvenience of movie screening times in the comfort of your own home with your pod. So that's my weird endorsement. Awesome, Craig.
So mine is the film that I watched this weekend and just thought was like so cool is and I'd seen it before, but I would make it my unpaid endorsement is The Silent Partner, which is an old movie. It's an old Elliot Gould movie from 1979, and it is a very classic bank robbery movie, but it has just a really strong, great premise in that it's basically like the bank manager of this bank, played by Elliot Gould, that's a bank in the mall, in a shopping mall, recognizes that like somebody is casing the joint, and that the guy who is the Santa at the Christmas Santa guy at the mall is actually casing the place for a bank robbery. So he decides to be ready the day that the bank robbery happens and just puts a little bit of extra money in his own briefcase. And then the Christopher Plummer plays the Santa in a very weird role, a very weird Christopher Plummer performance. And he recognizes that there's more money that was said has been stolen than he actually got.
Like the news is like the thief got away.
$50,000.
Yeah, and he's I've got 10. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Cool. So like then it becomes this like other kind of
that's great
crime movie.
That's
and
great.
It's just got like 1970s. Elliot Gould, who is one of the coolest dudes.
Yeah,
world,
yeah, so. That's great. That sounds so
that's
good.
So cool. Yeah, I feel like sometimes you hear that like a premise, you know, these premises are like a dime a dozen, you know, like that's not what makes a good movie. And then there's just like a really amazing premise like that, or like Portrait of a Lady on Fire. The premise for that is just
so you're just like, okay,
fascinating, you know.
Yeah,
that you're like, yeah, that's a good movie just from the premise. What was the name one more time?
The Silent Partner.
Right, The Silent Partner.
1970.
Right. So he, the bank operator, is the silent partner in this.
Correct.
Yeah, that's great.
It's Daryl Duke, who's like a Canadian director, didn't make that many movies. Curtis Hanson wrote it.
Oh, cool.
Before he was a director.
Awesome. Yeah.
It's very cool.
Mr. Kaplan, what you got, sir?
Yeah. Do you guys know about the Everything But the Bagel seasoning?
I think you may have endorsed it before, but that's okay.
Guys, I'm doubling down on this.
Yeah.
Not double downing. Doubling down. I've turned so many people onto this seasoning. They have it at Trader Joe's, but they now, I think they have it at a lot of different places. Like my mother-in-law in Ohio, she has found it at like Aldi's or something.
Yeah, I think there are knockoffs of it for sure. Yeah.
But it just like transforms anything you put it on.
Well, so let me, for listeners at home, it's like literally what it sounds like. It's like dried onion, poppy seed, sesame seed, all the stuff that's on everything bagel.
And but salt.
But as a its own condiment.
What's on the outside of an everything bagel, except it's without the bagel part.
Let me tell you, my main use for it is when we order bagels. We'll get like a couple frozen bagels, and like sometimes they'll be like, we're out of everything, and I'll be like, it's fine. And then I just make my own everything bagel, but I don't know what to put it on otherwise.
Well, so that's like the number one thing is someone is an idiot and buys like a plain bagel and gives it to you. You put cream cheese on it, you put the everything but the bagel on top of it, and it tastes like an everything bagel. But then you can put it on eggs. You can put it like in a tomato soup. I mean, you can just stick it anywhere that you would put salt. But you want like a huge blast of flavor. and it's everything but the bagel. It's like changed my life. And when we run out of it, it's not pretty in this house. Yeah, everything but the bagel. Trader Joe's is where I get mine, but you can get yours wherever bagels are not found.
Did you try, Oren, did you try Jenny's ice cream had everything bagel ice cream as a flavor?
And I'm not into that. Like, they discontinued it.
It's supposed to be great. It's supposed to be like a cream cheese sort of base, and then like little flavor pieces in there. But they've stopped making it, so I've never been able to try it.
I will throw in just one more endorsement about related to Jenny's ice cream that I just did this week. Is if you ever want to send someone a thank you gift, and it's not, you don't want to send them like a bottle of wine or like a Starbucks gift card, you can mail them Jenny's ice cream. And it arrives in like this cooler box. So I just sent someone like a thank you gift, Jenny's ice cream. And I think it's like, imagine opening your door just like at 3 p.m. and there's like 5 pints of ice cream there. It's like, I don't know how you can make someone happier.
Wow, you're all large with the 5 pints.
Yeah,
like that's,
yeah, boy.
It's kind of, yeah. So that's $19 just for the shipping.
So you're like, well, so you
might
as well.
So you gotta do a few, yeah.
But it's... Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't just like send this to like my mom or something. It's someone that I felt like I really had owed a great debt to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Someone that I had hired a hitman, and he did an amazing job. So
awesome.
The Jennies. Well, cool. Craig, are you on social media? Do you tweet? Do you Instagram?
I have a Twitter that I am vaguely active in. I have a very unactive Facebook page and a somewhere in the middle Instagram page. So, yeah, I'm
Let's
around.
See. At Craig Zobel with a white
Twitter
check mark.
Twitter is the way to like do it. Yeah, holler at me.
Yeah, there you go. Well, thanks, man. This was so great. After you're done following Craig, if you want to go ahead and follow.
And after you finished binging The Mayor of Easttown.
That's right.
Which actually will only come out one episode a week, right? Because HBO.
That's right.
So, yeah, so.
Okay, so don't binge.
You'll
it.
Have
Just
time and
consume it.
If you're catching up on episodes and this episode, you're not listening in real time, go ahead and binge it. But you can keep track of all of our episodes and all the other stuff that's happening on our show by following us on our social media at Just Shoot a Pod across all social networks. And you can follow me at Mr. Matt Enlow.
And you can also email us at justshootapod@gmail.com if you want to ask us about Craig, what he's like in person. We'll give you all of the dirt. You can follow me. I'm on Twitter at Smitey Pyleg and on Instagram at O'Kaplan. This episode was edited by Sarah Weirda. Our social media manager is Derek Aiello. Our consulting producer is Ali Kornfeld. You're listening to the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And thanks. We'll catch you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.